Good morning or good afternoon. Okay. And share screen. Okay. Not quite sure how that came about, but okay. Can everybody see my screen? Yes?
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. For some reason I can see my screen, but I can't see any of you. That's not good. Let's try this again. All right. Well, we'll make it work. Okay. In the last shiur that we had last week, or 2 weeks ago, if I remember, we discussed the nature of David's, sort of from the perspective of the Navi, David's crime, if you will, or the Mashal, and we looked at the Mashal from the perspective of the morality of it, or the Chet, in terms of David, let's leave it in the context of the Mashal. We didn't get into David yet. We got specifically dealing with the Mashal. And the Mashal was the wealthy taking advantage of the poor, seeing the Kivsa as a kind of an object rather than as a relationship with the Balabait, with the Isharash. And we compared it to the story in Shir HaShirim of the Dod and the Re'ah, with the brothers kind of looking at the Re'ah as a kind of a source for financial gain in terms of her work initially as a young girl, and then eventually the dowry expectation in terms of her a suitor or a suitable suitor, if you will, and then ultimately the Shir HaShirim ends with that crisis of the Dod proclaiming that he could give all the money in the world for his love, Boz Yavuzulo, they would despise him for it, and she encourages him to run away. And we kind of use that as a parallel to the story of the Ish Harash, who takes the Kivsa because she's nothing, it's a source of financial address to his needs, and without consideration for the personal relationship between the Ish Harash, the poor man, and the Kivsa. So we sort of left that open, and then we compared it, of course, to the story of David, who in his address to Bathsheba, or his dealing with Uriah, saw Uriah and Bathsheba in the kind of a technical context, the legal aspects of the relationship, without really addressing the emotional bond, the love that they shared, or that Uriah certainly is... that love of, you know, the emotional connection that they shared, and therefore the avla, the iniquity in terms of the crime that David had committed. So more or less that's where we left off. What we did not address, and we said we would come back to, is the number one, the broader picture, which we're not going to address today, which is why David got confused by this Mashal, why he didn't see himself in the story. That in itself needs to be is a question. But specifically, and the question that I wanted to address today, is David's reaction. When David responds, "Veicha af David ve'ish ma'od," David got very angry at the man, or about the man. "Vayomer Natan," he said to Natan, "Chai Hashem ki ben mavet ha'ish ha'oseh zot." Such a person is guilty, should be put to death. Man who has done this deserves to die. Ve'et ha'kivsa yishalem arba'atayim, and the lamb shall be, he shall pay for the lamb fourfold. Eikav asher asah t'davar hazeh v'asher lo chama. And of course, Natan's response to David is two words, Ata ha'ish. This is you.
Rabbi, is that an either or? In other words, is a person, the man supposed to die and his pay fourfold, or die or pay fourfold?
Only a Beis Din is exempt from doing both. B'dei Shemaim, the obligation would be both. David's response here is both. Ben Mavet, ve'etek yisa yishalim arba'atayim. He deserves to die, and he shall restore the lamb fourfold. It's true that in the laws of a Beis Din, you can't do both. It's a principle in halacha called kamle b'derabba mineh. If you're guilty of a capital offense and a financial offense, you only get the worser of the two punishments, but that's bidei adam. That's in the hands of the Beis Din. This is David's proclamation, I think, is more in the hands of bidei shemayim than anything else. But yes, in his proclamation, the onish would be both. And I think in Natan's response to David, he throws at him both punishments, right? Cherev lo tasum mibeitcha, the sword shall not depart your house, right? That is exactly the reference to kibin mavet, right? To death. And then kivsei shalem ba'atayim, we'll see how that plays out, but that is also part of the punishment. So that's certainly the expectation or the understanding here in the context. The question that I want to raise is the kivsei shalem ba'atayim fits the mashal, right? If you steal a keves or a bakar, that's a pasuk in the Torah, then you are I have to pay back four or five. That's a pasuk in Parashat Mishpatim in Shmot Perek Chav Aleph. Ki gnov ish shor oseh utvacho mecharo chamisha bakai yishlem tachat ashor ve'arba tzon tachat aseh. If you steal an ox or a sheep and slaughter it or sell it, you shall pay five for the ox and four for the sheep. This is really the reference to fourfold. David is borrowing from the language of the Chumash, specifically in the context of the crime. The crime was he stole this poor man's keves, or kivsa in this case, and he slaughtered it. He prepared it for a meal for his guest. So he was certainly guilty of taking the keves, ki gnov ish shor oseh, and utvacho macharo, and selling it or slaughtering it, in this case, killing it. And therefore he cannot pay back the actual animal, so the Torah says he shall pay back fourfold. Arba tachat haseh. That's exactly what David says, v'tekivsei shalem arba time. The question that is an obvious one is, where do you get this reference to ki ben mavet ha'isho sezot? How is that a capital offense? In the language of the Torah, stealing a keves, if that's the mashal, if David is staying within the bounds, within the limits of the mashal, taking the mashal at face value, that we're dealing with the stealing of a lamb, and that's why he invokes the fourfold penalty, then staying within the realm, within the parameters of that halacha, it's a financial crime, not a capital crime, and therefore, where does the ben mavet come from? So I shared with you a couple of weeks ago that the mafarshim are split over how to understand this ben mavet. The mafarshim are split over how to understand ben mavet. The Radak says ki derech guzma, that it's a expression of exaggeration, hyperbole. Right? David didn't really mean that he should die. He just meant, the kind of casual reference someone would make in an emotional state when they're angry at somebody and they say, he should be shot. You know, that kind of colloquial expression that comes rolling off the tongue. He should be shot for that. He doesn't really mean it. He just says, he's ben mavet. He should be deserved to die. Such a terrible thing. On the other hand, there are other mefarshim, the Malbim, who says, mitzat ha'isha po'el chayav mita, that he is chayav mita. It is a capital offense, and he should be put to death. Rashi kind of splits the hair. Hagozel et ha'ani ki'ilu notel et nafsho. If you steal from a poor man, it's as if you take his soul, meaning it's as if you've killed him. Et nefesh ba'alav yikach. So it's kind of, this is connects to a concept in Chazal, Midrasha concept of ani choshev kemeis, that a poor man is equivalent as like a dead person. So if a person causes somebody else to become poor because they've taken away the one thing that they have, so there's an element of ki'ilu notalat nafsho. But does that mean that he's actually guilty of an offense for which is a capital crime and capital punishment? That is difficult to process. So we're left with this mystery. What does David mean when he says ben mavet ha'ish hazeh? You could argue that it is hyperbole and lashon guzma, but Natan doesn't see it that way, because when Natan flips it around and Natan says to him ata ha'ish, and he decrees the punishment, and we'll see the fourfold punishment as part of it, he also says lo tasur cherev min betcha ad olam. The sword is also part of the punishment. Ki ben mavet ha'ish. So this is where I want to start the discussion today, is what does David mean when he says ben mavet ha'ish ha'osezot, and is there really a possible context in which this could be understood literally? And the truth is that we're going to get a little technical today, but that's okay. Once in a while we have to do that. David points to this halacha of Gonev ish sho oseu tvacho mecharo. The reference to et kivsai shalem arba'atayim, the fourfold punishment, comes from this pasuk. To find a phrase that equals or that's connected to this story of ben mavet at ha'osezot, that he deserves to die, we don't have to actually look very far. Part of the problem we have with Chumash is somewhere along the line somebody divided Chumash up into chapters. That was not done by us by Jewish tradition. Jewish tradition divides Tanakh up by paragraphs, not by chapters. This is the beginning of a paragraph. And the paragraph, as you can see, at the end of this pasuk, is the end of the chapter, but if there's no paragraph mark here, samach or pei, which means that this paragraph continues into the next chapter. If I was to look at it in Chumash, you'd see it's one paragraph. I could have pulled up a tikkun, I didn't think of that. What's the next pasuk? So we're going to jump to the beginning of the next parak. And the next parak begins the following. Im b'machteret yimatzeh ganav v'ukav amet. If the thief is found breaking in and is struck so that he dies, ein lo damim. There is no guilt of bloodshed for him, says the translation here. I'll show you what that translation could also mean in a moment. Im zarcha shemesh alav, if the sun rises on him, then damim lo. Then there is a guilt of bloodshed. Shalem yishalem im ein lo, then he shall make restitution if he has it. V'nimkar b'gnevato, if he doesn't have it, then he'll be sold for his theft. And the third pasuk, im himatze timatze biyado gneva, if the property is stolen in his hands, mishor ad chamo ad semach ad zeh chayim, alive, in contrast to selling or slaughtering, then shnayim mishalem shall pay double. So these four psukim together, let me show you them one after the other. Okay, so here is a page, my source page, in which you have the four psukim, one after the other. Perek Chaf Aleph Pasuk Lamed Zayin, Psukim Aleph and Bet of Perek Chaf Bet, and Pasuk Gimel of Perek Chaf Bet. In the halacha, these are three different cases. Okay, the way the halacha understands these are three separate cases. Case number one, ki gnov ish shor osef, a person steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, so it's no longer alive, he doesn't have it. Then he has to pay fourfold or fivefold. Chamisha bakai yishlem tachat ashor ve'arba tachat atzon. That's one halacha. Separate halacha altogether. Skip for a moment. Psukim aleph and bet. Pasuk gimel. If he does have the gneva, let's say he steals an ox or he steals a sheep, and he has it still alive, it's still intact, then unlike the case in Pasuk Lamed Zayin where he has to pay fourfold, because he has it intact, it's alive, he can pay back and give back the sheep, then Shnayim Mishalem, he only has to pay double. That double is what we call a knas, it's a fine. So he gives back the original capital that he stole, and then a double, a portion, a fine. Whereas if he stole it, or if he killed it, slaughtered it, or sold it, and we'll see what the significance of that is in a few minutes, then he has to pay four or five fold. So these two psukim, Lamed Zayin of Perachav Aleph, and Pasuk Gimel of Perachav Bet, these two psukim are actually part of what we would say two alternative versions of the same story. Stole a sheep. If he slaughtered it, he has to pay back fourfold. If he didn't, it's still alive, it still can be returned, then he has to pay back double. So far, you with me? Okay. In between, sandwiched in between these two halachas, which seem to be connected, there's a third mitzvah, there's a third halacha. And in the way the Gemara understands this mitzvah, with the way the halacha understands, Torah Shabbat Peh understands this, these two psukim, is that it's a third scenario. What's the third scenario? It's called in the halacha a case of Baba Machteret. Baba Machteret is somebody who, what we would call in the legal language, breaking and entering. Somebody who, in the stealth of night, breaks into somebody's house. Now, that case has a unique scenario. When you steal a flock or a member of the flock, you steal an ox or a sheep, you're outside, you're at the pen, you're in the field, you take the animal and you go. Here, Baba Machteret, you're coming into the house. You're choter et abayit. You're stealthily entering into the house. That's a separate case. And there, and I'm going to jump to Rashi for a second. In b'machteret, if a person stealthily breaks into a house, choter et abayit, then the Torah says, hukah v'met, and he is killed and dies, ein lo damim. Translated simply, it means that the balabayit, the owner, house owner who kills him, is not guilty of any offense, he's not held accountable for the spilling of his blood, he killed him, and he is exonerated from any crime. Whereas imzacha shemesh alav, if the morning sun rises, it's no longer the middle of the night, then he can't kill him, damim lo, he has blood, meaning he cannot kill him, shalem yishalem, he has to pay the fine. In accordance with whatever it is that he stole, if it's available, if it's still alive, then he pays back double, if it's not, he sold it, then he pays back four or five. But if you look at Rashi, ein lo damim.
That's a little confusing, Rabbi. There's no blood in the daylight. So he hasn't been killed in the daylight by the owner? In other words, it's switching this.
He's been killed, but he's held accountable.
At night.
At night, if he kills him, he's not accountable. In daytime, if he kills him, he is accountable.
But then, who's paying whom?
Hold off on the why.
Who's paying whom? Who's paying whom? He still goes on to make compensation. Shalem yishalem.
In other words, damim lo means you're not allowed to kill him. That's what it means. Okay. If you do, you're obviously guilty of a capital offense. If not, then he'll pay back the fine. Okay, now this phrase, ein lo damim, if you look at Rashi, based on the Gemara, Rashi explains it in a way that is a little different. it doesn't necessarily only mean it mean lemais, it means the same thing, that a person, the balabait, has the authority to kill the ganav. But it's, and so here's what Rashi, how Rashi explains it. Ein lo damim, ein zu ritzicha. If the balabait kills the ganav, it's not called murder. Why? Hareyu kimet meikaro. Because the moment the thief broke into the house, it is as if he's already a dead man. And therefore, killing him is not spilling blood, because his blood was forfeit the moment he broke into the house. What's the concept? Kan limadotcha Torah. From here, the Torah has taught us a very profound lesson. Imba lehorgecha hashkem lehorgo. If a person comes to kill you, kill him first. We call this, in simple terms,
self-defense.
Somebody comes to kill you, kill him first. How does that apply to a ganav? Now here's the principle, and it's very important. Vizeh, this ganav who's broken into your house, is guilty of breaking and entering, lehorgecha ba, he's coming to kill you. Why is he coming to kill you? Sherei yaduahu, because it's known, it's assumed. It's known in the Torah's mindset that a person is not going to let somebody break into his house and steal his property and remain silent. Therefore, it's clear to the ganav that the balabait, if he catches the ganav in the act of breaking and entering and trying to steal something, the balabait is going to try to respond. Therefore, the ganav is going to counter. And the ganav comes prepared to counter. Lefichach amanat kemba. This ganav comes into the house with the explicit indication, willingness, to deal with the balabait if the balabait stands in his way. She'im ya'amod bal hamamon kenegdo yargenu. If the balabait stands in his way, he'll kill him. And because the ganav is prepared to kill the balabait in the case of the balabait defending his wealth, his financial, his house, his, right? Then, because the ganav is prepared to kill the balabait has every authority to kill the ganav first.
Only during the night.
Wait. Hang on a second. Now,
okay.
What does imzecha shemesh alav mean? Right. This nighttime-daytime distinction makes no sense whatsoever. So Rashi explains it based, again, it's all based on the Gemara. Ein ze ela kemin mashal. This nighttime-daytime distinction is nothing more than a parable. Meaning, im barur lecha davar sheyesh lecha shalom imach. If it's clear in your minds that this ganav is not going to kill you, you know for a fact this ganav, even though he's broken into your house, even though he's coming in guilty of breaking and entering, but he's not going to kill you. It doesn't fit the story of the first paragraph. Barur kishemesh, as clear as the daylight, hazeshu shalom ba'olam, that brings peace in the world. Kach pashut lecha she'en lo balogacha, if you know for clearly that this ganav is not going to come to kill you. Afilu ya'amod bala mamon kinegdo, even if the owner stands in his way. What kind of a case is that, where you know for sure the balabait is not going, the ganav is not going to kill the balabait? So Rashi gives an example which I don't necessarily know is accurate in today's society, but nonetheless. Kegon av achoter legnov mamon aben. A father breaks into his son's house to steal. In that case, the father's not going to kill the son, no matter what happens. Therefore, it loses the category of a capital crime, meaning it loses the issue of a skein fashot. The balabait can no longer kill the ganav, because he knows that the ganav is not going to try to kill him, and therefore the issue of self-defense falls away. That's how the halacha understands the zacha shemesh alav. Can't be a distinction just if he breaks in the middle of the day versus breaks in at night. That makes no sense. It must be that it is if the sun shines on the story, meaning it's clear as day that he is not guilty of, he's not going to try to kill the Balabait, then you don't have the right of self-defense.
Who has decided that that's okay to say, that a father won't kill a son? I mean, do we just accept that?
That's an assumption in that case that he's used as an example. If the scenario is such, whether it's true and whether it applies or not is unique to each circumstance, that's for the Beis Din to decide. But if it's clear to you that the ganav is not going to kill the balabait, then you don't have the right to kill the ganav. That's the principle.
Interesting, you didn't say the sun breaking, vice versa. Yeah, that would exactly.
In today's world, it might be in reverse, but all right.
Right.
This is just like the sunshine law in Missouri. If somebody
stand your ground law.
Right.
It's called the castle doctrine.
Right.
So this is exactly where the castle doctrine finds its source in. Meaning, and this castle doctrine is a principle of law that applies in most states in the country, probably in most countries as well. It has its source in exactly this halacha, Baba Machteret. Person breaks into your house. He's coming to steal. But the rule is, and this is an example from Missouri, that you could look it up in any legal text, or you can, today's world, you can Google it. Castle doctrine is a principle of legal term. Missouri recognizes the castle doctrine and allows residents to use force against intruders without the duty to retreat, based on the notion that your home is your castle. The legal doctrine assumes that if an invader disrupts the sanctity of your home, they intend to do you harm. There is that exact same assumption. They intend to do you harm. Therefore, you have the right to repel their advances and defend yourself. There's an assumption that a ganav is prepared to kill you. You, therefore, have the right to kill them first. It is considered an act of self-defense. Okay, how much deadly force you're allowed to use gets into the cases of each state and in each jurisdiction, whether or not you can... if you reasonably believe such force is necessary to protect yourself or someone else from the use of imminent use of unlawful force, the whole discussion. I'm not going to get into the details of it, but the concept of the castle doctrine, which is discussed in every legal system, will address the parameters of the right of self-defense in your own home. If a ganav enters into your territory, comes into your castle, it all stems from this halacha in Baba Machteret. It comes in, you have the right to kill it. In other words, the uniqueness of this halacha is very important. Everybody agrees that there's a concept called self-defense. That's not debated. There's no question. If a person stands there with a gun pointed at your head, you have the ability to shoot him, you have the right to do so. On the contrary, if a person is holding a gun to somebody else's head, you, as a third party, have the right to kill the person. He's not even threatening you, he's threatening somebody else. But you have the right to kill him. That halacha is called third party, right? Point person A is trying to kill person B. I can kill person A. What's that halacha called? What? Right. You follow the scenario? If I see, it's not even the question, he's coming to kill me. He's coming to kill me is called self-defense. But if person A is trying to kill person B and I have the ability to stop them by shooting them, I have the right and even obligation to do so. That's called
Rodef or something.
Rodef. That's a Rodef. Right? Person A is pursuing. He's a pursuer. He's pursuing person B. I have the right to use deadly force to stop them. That's a classic case of Herodif. What's unique here in the case of Baba Mechteret is that the Torah has two possible ways of looking at the law of Herodif. Who's the Herodif? Who's the Nirdif? Who's pursuing whom? The Ganav comes into my house in order to steal. I'm going to defend myself. So what am I going to do? I'm going to come at this Ganav, who has not pointed a gun at me, who has not threatened my life. He's just rummaging through my property. I'm going to take out my shotgun and kill them. Who's pursuing whom? Right? They're just rummaging through my drawers. I pulled out a gun and shot them.
Who's but there's very unlikely to be a third person in the house.
Get the third person for a second. Just right. I brought in the Rodev case just to understand the concept. There's a concept called Rodev. In the case of the Balabait and the Ganav, the Ganav is rummaging through my safe. He's trying to break into my safe. I pull out a gun and shoot him. Who's in the Rodev? Who's the Nirdav? Who's the pursuer? Who's threatening the life of the other?
The Balabait is threatening the life of the
Balabait is the Rodev.
The Ganav didn't come in thinking he's going to kill the owner. Oh, he didn't.
That is exactly how
that's the assumption we're making.
That's the Torah's reversal. What the Torah says is that ordinarily I would see this as a case where the Balabait is the Rodev because the Ganav didn't threaten the Balabait. But the Torah's analysis of it is Baba Mechteret. He came in stealth. Because he came in stealth, he assumes the Balabait is going to try to defend himself. He's prepared to kill the Balabait if he needs to defend himself. The Torah flips it around and now considers the Ganav as the Rodef. That's the Halacha Baba Mechteret. And that, by the way, is also the principle of the castle doctrine. In Western society, that's exactly how it is perceived.
Rabbi, not to get too political, but in our present time, we've seen so much abuse of that doctrine.
I don't get political and I don't get contemporary. I do Tanakh.
Okay, Tanakh, but I think we've seen more abuse of that principle that's not represented in Tanakh today or in the Talmud. Maybe it is represented in the Talmud.
We can get into whether the parameters of it. I'm just giving you the broad sketch of it.
Gotcha.
I want to make it very clear. Western society acknowledges this principle and applies it in legal terms. Missouri recognizes a castle doctrine. The castle doctrine allows a resident to use lethal force, even if the person coming into his property does not point a gun at him. But if there's a reasonable assumption that there's a possibility that he could be a threat to my life, I have the right to defend my castle, even at the extent of taking the life of the Ganav. You've entered, the breaking and entering into my domain, into my castle, has essentially forfeited your life to me. That's the principle in the Torah. Ein lo damim. He has no blood, meaning it's like a person without blood. A person like without blood is not alive. So it doesn't. If I kill him, I'm not the Rodef. He's the Rodef. I have the right of self-defense to apply in this prisk. Hareu kemet meiko.
Is this the big exception to the Rodef concept?
Well, overall? It's a flip of it. It reverses it. It reverses the Rodef by applying it to the Ganav rather than to the Balabait. Okay? That's the principle of Baba Mechteret. Now, why is this relevant to us? Because David says two things. But these two statements are remarkably contextual to this passage. On the one hand, he says, "Et hakivsa yishalem arba'ataim," he'll pay back fourfold, which points to here. And on the other, he says, "Ben mavet ha'ish," he is deserving to die. Now, you could look at it from the perspective of, okay, it's just an exaggeration, as the Radak says. He isn't really going to kill him. It's just a Ganav. A Ganav is not Chayav Misa. On the other hand, Malbim says he is Chayav Misa. There's only one case that we know of in which a ganav forfeits his life, by definition. And that's the case of Baba Machteret. In Baba Machteret, ein lo damim, he has no blood, meaning he is a dead man, which is another way of saying ben mavet ha'ish. Right? The phrase that David uses, ben mavet ha'ish, is a way of saying, not that he's deserving to die, but it's a phrase or a coin of a phrase that flips around the same concept that's here in the case of Baba Machteret. He'll pay the sef fourfold, and because he's Baba Machteret, because he fits in this category, then, therefore, ein lo damim, it's permissible to kill him, or, in the case of the language that David uses, ben mavet ha'ish, the man deserves to die. The question that we need to ask ourselves is, how does Baba Machteret fit the story of the Kivsa, of the Mashal? You see what I'm trying to address?
Which right.
I'm sitting here at the phrase of Arbataim, and I'm sitting with the phrase Ein Lo Damim, which is remarkably similar to the phrase David uses of Ben Mavet Ha'ish. I'm so close. So what I really need to understand is why David saw the case of Baba Machteret relevant to the story of this Mashal.
Why didn't Natan see it?
Natan, I think...
He made the Mashal. In other words...
I think that was the intention.
Right. Natan is basically... David looked through the window and saw her. He entered her space.
We'll get to Bacha. I'm still at the Mashal level.
Okay. Sorry.
So what's going on? The truth is that I want to take us back into Chumash for a second and leave the halacha for a second. I'm going to do something a little bit dangerous, but try to look at this from a perspective of the pshat of the psukim independent of the halacha. The pshat of the psukim independent of the halacha is a little different than the way Torah Shabbat Peh sees these psukim. Torah Shabbat Peh sees these three as three separate cases. But I'm going to argue that in Chumash, this is one paragraph. And that really what the Torah is describing here is, it's actually one, the whole thing is one paragraph. What the Torah is describing here is two different scenarios. Forget the case. Forget the specific case of breaking into a house. But what the Torah is describing are two different scenarios of two types of ganavim. What I would call the amateur and the professional. Or the person who steals because he needs to put bread on this table, and the professional mobster. Okay? Let's put it in those terms. Person who steals because they need to put bread on the table typically will steal and then, let's say they, to borrow the phrase from Les Mis, right? I stole a loaf of bread to feed a starving child. Okay? You steal a loaf of bread because you're starving. What are you going to do with that bread? You're going to sell it?
Eat it.
You're going to eat it. So if you're caught, whatever the scenario is, let's assume for the moment, I'm not going to make it so extreme, but you're caught, the bread's still there. So the bread's still there. You can, if you steal it, you return it, you pay a fine for it, etc. But essentially the purpose of stealing from the perspective of somebody who is poor and who goes and steals, who's an amateur and who goes and steals because they're desperate, that is a person who would typically keep whatever it is they stole. Take, for example, let's deal with a different example. Let's leave the world of... I'm going to stop sharing for a second. Let's leave the world of animals and oxen and sheep. Let's talk about what's stealing a car called? Grand larceny, right? Let's talk about stealing a car.
Carjacking.
Carjacking is a little different. Steal a car. Person comes into a house. Person sees a car sitting on the side of the street. It's unlocked. It's a nice car. He wants the car, and he can see himself driving it around. And he takes the car, gets in the car, steals it, drives off with it. drives, whatever he does with it, drives it for a couple of days, then he abandons it. Okay? It's a classic example, a ganav. A professional ganav is going to take that car and do what with it?
Take the parts.
A professional ganav is not going to drive around. Exactly right. A professional ganav is not going to drive around in a stolen vehicle with the plates on so that he can be traced and caught and sent to jail. He's going to take the vehicle and take it apart and sell the parts. Because you can't drive a stolen vehicle around, you'll get caught, but you can sell the parts and make a lot of money. In other words, that's exactly the scenario of tavachu machar. If you take the animal and you slaughter it or you sell it, you're doing so because you're taking it and selling it for its parts. You're not doing it because you want to put food on the table. Whereas the ganav who it's found in his possession, the object that he steals is found in his possession, is doing so, he's stealing because he is hungry, because he needs something to eat. In other words, what the Torah is presenting in specific cases, if we extrapolate backwards to the broader context, is the difference between a casual thief and a professional thief. Between a ganav who just out of desperation steals something, and a ganav who is a professional who takes what he steals, who sells it, who slaughters it, who is in, that's his profession, is to engage in this kind of activity. That's a much more serious type of offense. And that is also somebody who is more likely to be Baba Machteret, right? A professional thief is more likely to enter into the world of breaking and entering, stealth, covering his foot, his tracks, making sure that nobody can catch him. Usually will come armed to protect himself. A casual thief who walks in to steal something is not necessarily going to be armed. But a professional, a mobster, is always going to carry weapons with them. They're considered by the Torah as perpetually in the status of a rodef. If you cross their path, you take your life in your hands. And that's essentially what the case of a Baba Machteret is. Baba Machteret is not just the scenario of he broke into the house and therefore he's prepared to kill the Balabait, etc. Baba Machteret is a way of extrapolating the context of what we would, in our language, call a professional thief versus an amateur, who you know is going to try to carefully consider the plan of every act, who's going to cover his tracks, who's going to be armed, who's going to take care of anybody who stands in his way, and who is therefore perpetually a rodef, and who is going to sell whatever it is they steal as quickly as possible for its constituent parts, rather than allow themselves to be caught by driving around in the Mercedes that they just stole from up the block. And that's the scenario to which the story that David is presented, David compares this to, he says, Ben Mavet Ha'ish. This is not a casual thief. This is not a person who broke into a house in order to steal because he had to put a loaf of bread on his table. This is the Ashir who stole this Kifsa from the Ish Harash. This Mashal is best compared to a case of Baba Machteret. Baba Machteret is a professional, a thief with all of the intentionality that comes with being a mobster. He'll have to pay fourfold because he's Baba Machteret and the damim. He's considered a ben mavet. This is a professional, and it is the lowest kind of activity that a person can do, because he literally has made his whole professional world around taking advantage of somebody else. So that, I think, is where David is kind of putting the story. It's not just about stealing the kivsa or the keves, right? You could argue that it's right, the kivsa is still alive, yishalim shnayim. No, we're not dealing with a case of that. We're dealing with a case of a professional. We're dealing with the case of Baba Machteret, with all of the efforts to disguise his efforts and disguise his ways and to steal within the context of the legal framework. If you remember our discussion last week, where we talked about the fact that he's trying he's not breaking into the Ish HaRash's home. He's not breaking into the man's home to steal this kivsa. He's coming to him and saying, okay, you owe me money, or you owe me he owes it to me anyway. I've lent him money over the years. How many chasadim have I done for him? And he has, I'm going to take it because it's mine, because there's a different style to such a thievery. Disguises it within the legal framework of the law and hides his true intentions. That's already an offense that qualifies, that comes closer to the case of a professional thief rather than an amateur. And that's essentially what David's response is. This man, this Ish Ashir, this wealthy man who takes advantage of the Ish HaRash by taking this loan, this object that he owes him anyway, and he's going to take advantage of him, and he's going to walk into his house, and he's going to take it at his most vulnerable. He's not going to listen to the laws of the Torah related to Bechutz Tamod, etc. This is the lowest because he's hiding it within the, quote, letter of the law, makes it even more despicable morally. And that's what David throws the book at him for. He says, this is Baba Machteret. This is a professional. This man is in this category of Ein lo damim et kisa yishalem arba'atayim. So whether or not he's going to kill him, or he decrees a kind of a death sentence on him, is not the issue. I think it's a language that he uses that links us to the domain, to the world of the professional thief, which is so immoral in David's mind.
So we have to then take the conclusion that David did this. His thinking was that this is a professional thief and not that this was an off-the-cuff remark.
Correct.
And we just assume that that's the correct way to think about it.
In other words, that's what David accuses this man of doing. Now, when it gets reversed, right, then that's exactly what Natan will say back to him, Atah Ish. Right? When we get to the Nimshol, and Natan says to him, okay, well, guess what? This is you. I hold a mirror up to what you've just done. Okay, you've stolen his wife. You tried to cover his tracks. You had him killed. You did everything that a professional thief would do. Okay, so that's exactly the issue. I'll show it to you in a different context. Take a look, for example, at this pasuk. It's a pasuk in the beginning of Sefer Micha. I just want to show, highlight the address to why David reacts the way he does. This is a pasuk in Sefer Micha. It's a separate Navi, separate time. But I want you to see the context in which Chazal, in which the Nevi'im dealt with this issue over and over again. So here's two pasukim. Hoy choshve aven ufoale ra al mishkevotam. Woe to them that devise iniquity and work evil upon their beds at night, whereas be'or haboker ya'asuha. But they perpetrate this evil in the morning light. Ki yesh le'al yadam, because they can. In other words, I can steal by literally stealing something in the middle of the night when nobody's looking. That's one type of stealing. But there's a much worse type of stealing, which is in broad daylight, where upon my bed at night, I just contemplate what kind of evils I can perpetrate. But I execute them in broad daylight, hiding in plain sight, because I can. V'chamdu sadot, they covered fields, v'gazalu, and they seize them. How? By forging documents and by bringing legal lawsuits and by whatever they want to do to abuse the system, they can, because they can do so in broad daylight. Uvatim v'nasau, they covet houses and they steal them away. You can't pick up a house and steal it, but you can in many ways force somebody into poverty and take their possessions and whatever other business ethic issues can be derived. Ashku geveru veto. Press a man in his house, the ish v'nachalato, or a man in his heritage. Take a look at the story that we looked at a couple of weeks ago, the story of Achav and the vineyard of Nevot. Right? What does Izebel do? Forges a document, has him accused of blasphemy, hires false witnesses, and by the time the story is over, Achav has seized a land, had his master, had its owner killed, and seized the land illegally, immorally, but nonetheless was able to do it. That was all in broad daylight. That wasn't by being a ganav in the middle of the night. Who's guilty of these kinds of crimes? So this nevuah continues. I'm just going to take you a couple more psukim for through it. Beginning of Perek Gimel, it's all one nevuah. V'omar shimuna rashei Yaakov uktzinei Beit Yisrael. Listen, you heads of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel. Halo lachem ladat tamishpat. Is it not for you to know justice? Son eto, you who hate good, ve'ohavei ra, and who love evil, gozlei oram me'alehem u'she'iram me'alatzmotam, who rob the skin off their flesh, off their bodies, and their flesh from their bones, ve'ochlu, v'asher ochlu she'er ami, who eat the flesh of my people. You, the leaders of the people, this is what you do. You steal from the poor. Through oppression, through the examples of Kerem Nevot, by in forged documents and in forged witnesses, whatever other evils you can contrive. Azizaku Lashem. They shall cry out to God. But he won't answer them. He'll hide his face from you because of all of the evils that you have done. Shimun azot rashei Beit Yaakov uktzinei Beit Yisrael. Listen, you heads of Jacob, rulers of Israel. Hamita'avim mishpat v'etkol ha'yishara ye'akeshu. You who abhor justice and pervert equity. Bonet Zion b'damim, who build Zion with blood. Yishalayim be'avla, and who build Yishalayim, the wealth of Yishalayim be'avla, with iniquity upon the backs of the poor. The heads, the judges, they take bribes. You can't do this without a corruption in the entire system. So the entire system has become corrupt, says Micha. Your judges take bribes. And the priests teach for hire. And all the false prophets who divine for money. And who say, oh, everything's great. And then, and then you come into the Beit HaMikdash and you say, God is with us? Is God not in the midst? Therefore nothing bad shall happen? So here's what will happen. Lachen biglalchem tzion sadet techavesh v'yushalayim yintiyeh v'harabayit levamot yaar. Tzion shall become plowed like a field, Yerushalayim shall become a destroyed heap, and the mountains of God shall become like a forest. In other words, this is coming to an end. This is exactly the kind of crime, the kind of chet, the kind of iniquity, the kind of immorality that the Nevi'im cried out about all the time. Dafka, the crimes perpetrated by the wealthy, by the powerful, by the judges, by the priests, by the rulers, by the kings, because they had the power to do so. In an environment in which nobody was standing up to them or stopping them. And usually the crimes are committed by the powerful are usually perpetrated against the powerless or the weak. And that's the case of Baba Machteret. That's the case of Ben Mavet Ha'ish. That's what David says. And to all of this, Natan responds and says, "Vayomer Natan al David, Ata Ish. All of this, David, is you." And in two words, he has removed the curtain, the veneer, from David's world. He has removed what's the word I'm looking for?
veil?
The veil or the protection, the illusion,
camouflage.
Protection, that the armor that David has built around himself to convince himself that everything he did was fine. He wrote a get to Bathsheba, or maybe he's not even Jewish, or maybe she's converted. He's converted, or he was married by Malchus. Everything that David has done to delude himself into thinking that this is acceptable. And in two words, Nathan says to him, take a step back. Forget the legal issues for a second. I don't care about the legal issues. Legal issues are fine, l'chumra, but this is you can't use the legal structures to commit immoral acts. And you have convinced yourself that you are legally within the right. You have been guilty of exactly what you just described as ben mavet ha'ish. You as a professional, you as the leader, you as the powerful, you as the king. You were the one who went and stole Baba Machteret in the middle of the night, who stole this woman from her husband. You were the one who decreed that he should be put to death in order to cover your tracks. You were the one who used the position of your authority and your power to take advantage of Uriah and his wife. Ataish. With a kind of the pause, if you notice this, I find the paragraph structure here so powerful that this samach here and this samach here indicates that these five words are a paragraph unto themselves. Vayomer Natan al David, ata ha'ish, this is you, and then everything stops. This samach means that Natan doesn't continue; he'll get to the onesh. But right now, he needs David to process. Ata ish, this is you. And it's an extraordinary window into the mindset, the worldview of the Navi, who takes the... We live in a very legalistic world. We live in a very halachic world where we structure our worlds, our activities around what's legal, what's halachic, what's permissible, what's doable, what's within the letter of the law. The Nevi'im at some point or another took a step back and they said the letter of the law is irrelevant if the outcome is immoral. I want to process that for a second. The letter of the law is irrelevant if the outcome is immoral. That's what Natan says to David. All the excuses in the world have led you into a world in which you are acting in exactly the same manner as those powerful leaders who Micha describes as stealing and corrupting and perverting because they can, because they have the power to do so within the letter of the law. Natan says to him, Ata Ish, that's you. Is that what you've become? Is that the great David, pious David, righteous David, fear, God-fearing David, is that what you've become? And before Natan offers a punishment...
So Rabbi, is that like...
Go ahead. Sorry, go ahead. What was that?
Is that like ain't Arab bli derech eretz, would you say?
On a much bigger scale, yes. In the world of the Nevi'im, it's much bigger than that. It's correct. That's a sort of a smaller version of it. Right? Derech eretz kadma la Torah. Basic derech eretz comes before, the way it's understood, it comes before issues, but... In the language of the Nevi'im, understand, legal frameworks are very important, especially in the mitzvahs menatam l'chmakam, between man and God, they're very important. Where they become questionable, or where they can become challenged, is in the domain of benatam l'chavero, if they are abused. In other words, the letter of the law is important to l'chumra, to protect us from perpetrating evils against our neighbors. But if the legal framework of the law can be used to create abuse, and we all know examples, modern day examples, where the letter of the law can be used to create abuse. Right? There are always loopholes in halacha. There are always loopholes that can be exploited to create, in any legal framework, to create circumstances of abuse. Example of get abuse is the one that comes to mind, but there are many. Where the legal frameworks and the legal structures can be used by evil people to create, to do immoral things. And that's where the Nevi'im come in and say, take a step back from the legal framework for a second and take a look at what you've done morally. You, David, Ata'ish, with all of the excuses you've identified for yourself, and there are many, comes along Natan and he says, this is immoral. I don't care how you got here. What you've done here is murdered Uriah and married his wife. How you got here doesn't matter. That's one of the reasons why Natan does not address the question of David's night affair with Bathsheba that first night. It's irrelevant. That was a one-night stand. That was an act of whatever legal justification you want. But that's not what Natan comes to criticize him for. That might be the way the door he opened a crack in order to walk in the house of where he is right now. But what Natan challenges him for is the murder of Uriah and then taking his wife, Ratzachta v'gam yirashta. Because that's much bigger. In the moral picture of it, that's much bigger. Legally, you could argue the legal offense was worse that first night than it is the rest of the way through. Uriah was guilty of murder by Malchus. David had him killed for it. Now she's a widow. He's allowed to marry her. There's no legal issue whatsoever with David marrying Bathsheba. The legal issue was that first night, that first affair they had that first night. There is no legal issue with David marrying Bathsheba. And yet the Navi criticizes him for killing Uriah and marrying Bathsheba. Not for that first night. Because the Navi's not coming to address the legal issue. He's coming to address the moral issue. Ata ha'ish. This is you. You understand what I'm driving at? It's a very important piece. I want to take you one step further. This notion that the Nevi'im addressed the bigger moral questions rather than just the legal ones is huge. Because it understands the whole mindset of the Nevi'im. Not to belittle the legal framework, not to dismiss it, it has its place, but to understand the broader context. I'll give you another example. This one from Sefer Amos. This is a very famous one. At some point, at the beginning of Sefer Amos, and we read this as a Haftorah, Amos lashes out against all the nations of the region, and he comes to the crimes of Israel, the transgressions of Israel, and he makes the following declaration. Pasuk Vav, Koma Hashem, al shlosha pishei sovi al arba'alo ashivenu. I may forgive three, it's a stylistic issue. I may forgive three iniquities, but for the fourth I will not. What's the fourth iniquity that's the straw, the proverbial straw to break the camel's back? Amichram ba'kesef tzadik v'evyon ba'avur n'alayim. For selling a righteous person for money and a poor person for a pair of shoes. What is this pasuk talking about? What is this pasuk talking about? What crime have we committed to sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes? Sounds like?
Yosef.
Sounds like Yosef, right? So the medrash that Yosef was sold for a pair of shoes is taken from this pasuk. Yosef at tzaddik, sold for a pair of shoes. I'll show you the medrash. Medrash is here in Medrash Tanchuma. V'chi Yosef. The selling of Yosef, who is righteous, for a pair of shoes, is so described. Clearly, though, that's not the pshat. Right? That's the Medrash. It's not the Pshat. What is the Pshat? So take a look at the Mefarshim, and you'll see Rashi says it's referring to judges, Dayanim. Hayu mochrim et misha ya zakai bedin. They would sell somebody who was really innocent, but they would sell them into slavery because of shochat, with money taken from bribes. In other words, says Rashi in the Mefarshim, all this pasuk is referring to the corruption of judges that would take an innocent person and sell them as a slave because they would be able to get bribes from the wealthy side of the other on the other side of the court. Somebody who's a tzaddik, somebody who's righteous, somebody who is innocent, he sells them as the judge sells them into slavery because he can get paid for such an act. So says Rashi. I actually would argue that although that works conceptually, I don't think that's the pshat either.
Rabbi Shulman, can I what comes to my mind is during the Holocaust, Jews were given to the Nazis for a pound of sugar to be killed.
Okay, but I don't think anybody would contemplate for a minute that we could have been doing such a thing. That is beyond anything that we could contemplate. I think you're correct that that is a crime that baseless human beings can and have done. I can't believe Amos could be describing such activity.
No, who could imagine that?
No.
But I also think that sleeping with Bathsheba that first night, that opened the door to everything that followed.
Correct, but to the Navi he ignores it. Because had the door been closed then, open the door and closed it. But what happens here is that David has spiraled into a place that has now been... put it in these terms. Adultery is a crime that exists in society today. You cannot hold somebody legally accountable for adultery in today's society. It's a fact. Right? It's not considered a crime for which you can throw somebody in jail. Right. But murder is. Okay? David, let's assume for the moment the worst. David committed adultery. Okay? But then he committed murder. And that's where the Navi walks in. I have 3 minutes left. Let me just finish this phrase. Amichram b'kesef tzaddik. In the context of Sefer Amos, it's a very specific reference here, because what he's essentially describing is somebody engaged in slavery. And the question the Mefarshim struggle with is: did we as Jews, did we ever engage in selling people as slaves? And Amos's answer to that, the same Amos, pasuk bet, perek bet, the same Amos is. Answer is, we didn't engage in slavery, but we were guilty of the offense of engaging in slavery. And I'll explain what I mean. So here is the end of Amos, Perek Chet. Okay, and I'm going to jump to Pasuk Dalet. Here's, by the way, look at Pasuk Vav. Liknot bekesef dalim, to buy the poor for silver, ve'evyon ba'avon alayim, and the needy for a pair of shoes. That's exactly the same phrase, right? So Perek Bet, that phrase here in Perek Bet, and that phrase here in Perek Chet connect. What are we talking about here? So now take a look. Shimu zot ha-shoafim evyon. Listen, you who would swallow the needy, who would swallow them, v'lashbit aniyei aretz, and destroy the poor of the land. How? Lemor, matay yavor ha-chodesh, because you say, when will the new moon pass, meaning the new month begin? V'neshbira shever, so that we may sell our grain. V'ha-shabbat v'niftachabar, or the Shabbat, so that we may set forth corn. L'haktin eifa u'lahagdil shekel, to make the eifa small, and the shekel great, u'la'avet moznei mirman, to falsify the balance of deceit, to corrupt the weights, so that we have a ledger that is in our favor. Liknot bekesef dalim ve'evyon ba'avon alayim u'mapal bar nashpir, so that we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes, and sell the refuse of the corn. In other words, to Amos, this isn't about engaging in the slave trade, and it isn't about corrupt judges. It's about corrupt businessmen who would use the market to raise prices, to restrict produce, to create demand, and to let the prices go up in such a way that who, on the backs of whom, who is going to suffer most if the rates go up, if the market goes up, and if the costs go skyrocketing, but the weights are falsified, who's going to suffer the most? The poor. They can't afford it, and they have to sell themselves into slavery or indentured servitude in order to make ends meet. And the businessman comes along and he says, I'm engaging in nothing but business transactions. What are you coming to me for? I sell wheat. And the Navi says to him, you don't sell wheat. You sell slavery. That's what the Navi says. You think you're engaging in the commerce of wheat? I think you're engaging in the commerce of slaves. Because that's the end result. Because that's how the Navi looks at the world. It's not about the legal actions that one takes. It's about the perspective, the broader canvas of what happens to society as a whole because of the actions that I take. And when you are the leader of the people and you commit what seems on the outside of it, you know, it doesn't pass the smell test, but what looks like murder, and what looks like adultery, and what looks like corruption, with all the legal answers in the world, is usually murder, adultery, and corruption. And that's exactly what Natan says to David. Ata ha'ish. This is what you have done. You may not have seen it, may not have realized it, but that's the worldview of the Navi. And from here, we begin to find that we have to look at the onesh, we have to look at the punishment that was so decreed, and ultimately at what David responds, how he responds, and how he reacts moving forward. So essentially the map laid out before us is to understand the Gezerah of Natan, the decree against David, David's tshuva, and what it accomplishes, or what it doesn't accomplish, and ultimately how David finds himself both removed from the Malchus and restored to it. All of that is the remainder of Sefer Shmuel Bet. The one last piece of the Mashal that we haven't addressed, which I want to address Bezrat Hashem next week, is how it is that David did not see himself in this story before Natan threw it at him. So that Bezrat Hashem we will explore next week. Adina, you look like you have a question. No, all good. Okay. All right. So that's where we're at. I hope it's not the kind of shiur you can enjoy, but I hope you found it significant and meaningful. And Bezrat Hashem, we will continue next week.
Rabbi, vis-a-vis occupying Wall Street, what is your position?
I don't do.
You teach Tanakh. I got you. I got you the first time. I got you. It was in my head to make the joke. Sorry. But when I'm there at Wall Street, I'll put a little star in the wall.
I'm sure.
Can you do that? Have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much. It's beautiful. Very beautiful.